Okay, well, so this is an impromptu gathering. The stimulus for this was the presence in town of Martin Rees, past president of the Royal Society. And Martin and I filmed when I was last in England, when you were at Master of Trinity College. You were here for a fish shrift at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and we just had an impromptu lunch, and the two of the lunch guests, Terry Sanofsky, who runs the Computational Neurobiology Lab at the Salk Institute, and Larry Smar, who runs Cal-IT2, the Qualcomm Institute over the street at UC San Diego. We are in the Computational Neurobiology Lab because Terry kindly offered to host this little gathering, and we are to talk about some of the things that we talked about at lunch and also at the meeting yesterday. Let me start with this, because Martin, you're now running an institute called the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge, and I said at lunch that that didn't necessarily mean you had to understand Kierkegaard or Sartre or anything else. You're talking about risks that are coming along because of science and technology that have grave possibilities for humankind. It sounds a little bit doom-laden, but I think you have a different take on it than that.
Well, I think the main point we'd all agree on is that technology is getting more powerful and it offers huge benefits, but it also has a downside. And I think our aim in setting up this centre is to try and deploy the best expertise we can to ensure that those in charge are aware of these risks and, where necessary, one tries to implement the proper regulations and controls needed for responsible innovation so that we can benefit from these technologies and avoid the downsides. And of course, as we look ahead even 20 years, then the scenarios that some people talk about quite seriously seem almost like science fiction. What we can do in biotech and the capacity of machines, of human intelligence, etc. And so there are going to be all kinds of problems which are going to need to be addressed if we are to take advantage of these wonderful developments and avoid the hazards. And the hazards could be catastrophic because we are in an interconnected world where not just the internet connects us, but where pandemics can spread globally, etc. So our main aim really is to give a bit more focus on these, because whereas we have a huge amount of study of modest risks and we're perhaps over inclined to fret about small risks like radiation at low levels, carcinogens in food and things like that, many people are in denial about risks which are unlikely but which are so potentially serious that even one occurrence would be too many. And we think it's important to try and think in advance so that we can calibrate these potentialities and scan the intellectual horizon, as it were, and see what might happen in the next 20 years.
Yeah, this talk you gave to the World Science Fiction Congress 2 weeks ago in London.
Yes, yes.
Your last paragraph here, Spaceship Earth is hurtling through space, its entire life support system is vulnerable to breakdowns, its passengers are anxious and fractious. Those in charge lack the power and the perspective, but how they cope, how we cope during this crucial century, has consequences that will resonate throughout the cosmos. I mean, this is a pretty large topic.
So yes.
The three of you were talking about this. Terry, you were on that. We've got the sign up there that says the Brain Initiative. You've been talking a lot about neuroscience. Larry, you do a lot of stuff on technology. You're both dealing with big data and so on. Just up the street, we have Craig Venter's Genomics Institute. I mean, how are these things really impacting the average citizen who's probably more worried about whether the thing they're eating has got GMOs or whatever, you know what I mean? Start
well,
me off.
Yeah, the problem is that people do not think exponentially. It's just a fundamental thing. I've watched this for decades now. So the work when I was working with Martin back 40 years ago on simulations of accretion onto black holes and so forth. The computers today are, say, 100 million times faster. And yet we look around the world and we don't see anything catastrophic happening. And so we say, well, you know, if in the next 20 years, Moore's law is about a factor of 1,000 per decade, that will be another factor of 1,000,000 times, why should it be any different? But the problem is that's like the lilies. When you look at a pond and there's a lily pad and then there's two lily pads and there's four lily pads, and you don't pay any attention to it until it's half of the pond, and then you say, boy, one of these days I better worry about that. Can you take, and on the next day it's the entire pond, it's all over. And so take human intelligence. This decade, the decade we are living in right now, by 2020, it's quite likely that computers will cross the threshold of the speed of a human mind, the speed of a human brain. And in that next decade, 1,000 human brains. And this is what Ray Kurzweil and Werner Vinge, originally here, the science fiction writer, called the singularity. So that is going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years. And that's never happened before. So maybe it'll all work out just fine. But the thing is that people aren't thinking that something qualitatively different is going to happen. What I like to say about exponentials transform the impossible into the routine. And so they just sneak up on you, and they sneak up on society. And so what I'm so pleased that Martin has put this center together, because it isn't something that your politicians who are worried about the next election are going to concern themselves with, corporations worried about the next quarter are going to think about. It's something that you need to bring the world's intellectuals together to look out a distance beyond financial return, real estate concerns, but that will drastically alter the human condition.
So, Larry, let me ask you a question. In your scenario with a lily pond, how close are we to that, you know, halfway point?
I think we're within the last doubling or two, and this is why Martin wrote his book, Is This Humanity's Last Century? Or as he says in America, the last hour. So, I mean, it's an exponential. You know, it's this whole thing about, you look at the evolution of all of life, and, you know, humans appeared on Earth in the last second, basically. It's a 24-hour thing or something like that. And already, just look at climate change. So the point is that the collective use of energy in the world has reached a point where the unintended emissions of CO2 and other gases are actively changing the climate of the planet. And, you know, the Earth as a system doesn't really care. I mean, you know, it's been through a lot more CO2 than we're ever going to see from humans. And, you know, the Earth was just fine. Now, it wiped out vast numbers of species, and it, you know, made huge changes. But for the humans who have spent the last several hundred years optimizing where they grow food so that they can feed the
more and
population,
more.
Right? It's going to be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of issues that are at our doorstep. It's not really your grandchildren that are going to have to worry about this. We, in our lifetimes, are going to see these crises hit.
But let me take this last paragraph of Martin's here. Again, those in charge, because you wrote this, you said this, those in charge lack the power and the perspective. Its passengers are anxious and fractious. Now, we're not just talking about the kind of political debate that goes on about climate change. You're talking about a whole range of things here. We're talking about genetically modified organisms. We're talking about... take your area of the brain, for example.
Reverse engineering the human brain.
Right, right. Yes. So this is actually...
Hang on a second, because most people, when they watch a computer win the game show, think, that was very cool. Not, oh my God.
Well, what's driving that is big data. And the fact that we can now use computers that are so powerful to really sift through all of the data that the world, you know, has produced in the internet, and extract from that, you know, regularities, knowledge, and that's called learning. In the case of biological systems, we're taking in a huge amount of data every second. It's like a fire hose, and we sift through that very efficiently and pick out the little bits of data and incorporate that into the very architecture, the very hardware of our brain. And how that is done is something that neuroscientists today are just beginning to get to the mechanisms underlying memory, where in the brain and how that's done biochemically. But once we've understood that, once we know how the brain does it, it's going to be a matter of just another few years before that's incorporated into the latest computer algorithms. And already something called deep learning has taken over searches at Google, for example, for speech recognition and object recognition and images. And I'm told that Google Maps is now using that to help you navigate in terms of the where you are, what address of what street you're on. So this is happening, it's already happening, and Larry's quite right about that. This reminds me a little bit about a cartoon I once saw, a Disney movie, about the Sorcerer's Apprentice. And this was about an apprentice who was tasked with cleaning the sorcerer's apartment. And he managed to get a magic wand which would create a broom that would help him. Unfortunately, he didn't know how to turn it off, and so it kept doubling until it reached the point where the whole place was flooded. And the problem is that we're like the center's apprentice, in the sense we're creating the technology. But at some point, we will lose track of how to control it or being falling into dangerous hands. But, you know, I think the real immediate threat is just not knowing what the consequences are, unintended consequences that are already happening, that we're already beginning to glimmer. For example, the privacy issue of, you know, who has access to your data. That's something that hasn't been settled yet. The problem is it takes time to explore and settle these issues and make policies, and it's happening too quickly for us to be able to do that.
I mean, I think that's the real issue, is the time scale. Everybody's concentrating right now on the Ebola virus and its spread. And you think, well, you know, we'll come up with some way to stop it. Maybe it won't be easily transmitted. But I was talking to Martin earlier, you know, when HIV became aware of that in 1980. By 1990, we were spending $1 billion a year, and many of the best scientists in the world started working on the problem. That's 30 years ago. And the number of people with HIV is just now beginning to peak out 30 years later. Mm. Well, do we have 30 years with $1 billion a year and all the best brains on the planet to work on these projects? Do we have 30 years to get on top of some of these things? And that's what I am concerned about, is that by the time we see some of these things beginning to happen that are, let's just say, antisocial, either because of the inability of our government to come to any kind of decision about anything, or regulatory timescales, but what if the best minds on the planet, with the best will behind the society to get a solution to the problem, don't have time enough to do it?
Yeah, I think that's the worry, and I think it's the unintended consequences that we need to be concerned with, but also in the context of biology and viruses, which you mentioned, then there's been in the news quite recently issues about experiments being done in Wisconsin, which some people think are dangerous and should not be done, because they're modifying the virulence and transmissibility of viruses, and this could lead by mistake to some leakage. It could lead to knowledge that's plainly very dangerous if applied to other viruses. And this is just within the last year or so. And I think a real worry is that this knowledge is going to spread, it's going to get more advanced, and it doesn't require major facilities. It's not like building an atomic bomb. And so one of the worries I have is that it's going to be very hard to be sure that of the many millions of people who may have this expertise by 2050, not even one misuses it. Because one will be too many, if the possibility is some global pandemic. And this is the kind of thing I worry about very much, because we say, well, we must regulate these things, but enforcing regulations is hard. In the 1970s, there was the famous Asilomar Declaration, which imposed a moratorium and guidelines. And that worked because it was a small community at that time. But now we have a global community, we have much stronger commercial pressures. And my worry is that anything that can be done will be done somewhere by someone. And this I find very scary. And as to how we can guard against this, I think we're going to face a big tension between privacy and security. Going back to what Terry was saying, that we have all this information and we would like to be sure that we can find in advance someone who might be planning to misuse it. And I think that's a real problem for the future. And if I could perhaps go back to the quote you gave at the beginning, where I ended up with a sort of a purple phrase about resounding through the cosmos. I think as astronomers, we do bring one special perspective, which is that we're aware of the far future. We're not aware merely of the fact that it's taken 4 billion years for us to evolve, but we're aware that there are 4 billion years ahead of us on the Earth, and so human life is not the culmination. More evolution can happen on Earth and far beyond, and so we should be concerned not just with the effects that the downsides of these technologies have on our children and grandchildren, as it were, but on the longer term effects they have. And of course there's a big ethical issue about to what extent you weigh in the balance the welfare of people not yet born. Some people would say you should take that into account, and if that's the case, then that's an extra motive for worrying about all these long-term things like climate change, which will have their worst effects more than a century from now. If you're a standard economist and you discount the future in a standard way, then anything more than 50 years in the future is discounted to zero. And I think we ought to ask, is that the right way to think about future generations? You could perhaps instead have a different principle, that we should not discriminate on grounds of date of birth. We should value the welfare of a newborn baby as much as of someone middle-aged. And if we take that line, instead of straight economic criteria, we would be surely motivated to do more now to minimize these potential long-term threats. Because we want to not put the brakes on technology, we want to ensure that technology is directed so that we can have the benefits but minimize the risks of these downsides.
I used the end of your your talk, which, but as of course, you started with a reference and you went back to it at the end, but what you started with was the H.G. Wells quote about humanity has come some way, a distance we've travelled gives us some earnest of the way we have to go, all the past is but the beginning of the beginning. So you had this this longevity kind of...
And he was very unusual, of course, at that time in having this vision.
Right, right. But I mean so, but who implements all of this stuff? You have to have a general populace voting on these things. Your center, you're talking about developing technologies might lead, perhaps accidentally, perhaps very rapidly, once a certain point is reached, direct extinction level threats to our species. So what, if you three were a committee of some kind, I mean, what are the threats, specific threats, and how would you identify them? How do you propose going about them, and then who stops them? And
we can't yet be sure what is the boundary between what is a serious threat we should worry about and what is genuine science fiction. That's why the kind of thing which I feel we ought to do is to convene groups of experts to think about these issues, because the main concern I have is that these are under-discussed compared to other more routine problems. And so I think we want to make sure that we can deploy the best expertise to decide which are the threats, which are the dangers of the kind of research that we are all involved in. And then, of course, as to how we make this effective, we would obviously talk to politicians and governments, but also I think we should make the public aware, because there are two ways you can influence governments if you're a scientist. One is by being a government science advisor, The other is by being someone who does outreach to the public, because politicians respond perhaps less to direct advice from an expert than to the public who writes to them and who get in the media, because they respond to public pressure and to media pressure. And so I think if we can get a responsible view of these issues before a wider public and before the media, that will also help. But I think there is an intrinsic problem, because some of them are, although frighteningly short-term in a sense, as Larry says, they're long-term compared to the next election. And that's why it's hard to keep them up the political agenda.
Or as Lou was saying at the end of the thing yesterday, in terms of talking intellectually about these large threats, you know, how do you convey that to a member of the general public who's heard about the latest?
The Andromeda strain.
Yes.
So authors have already been at work informing the public about potential catastrophes, not always with the best scientific background. The public seems to be interested. And it is possible to get the public, if it's a credible threat. And my concern is that it's too easy to get the
It might lead to an anti-science crusade.
Exactly.
That's a danger.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm. So I think it's it's a very narrow
we got to be careful,
path that you have to take. So between being too.
But this was Branscombe's point yesterday at the end of the thing. He listened to all these grand and mentioned that when surveys were done of the general public, they were more concerned about, well, is that going to interfere with my garden there? Is that going to get on the end of my street?
Well, I would say that may be true, but let's look at GMO.
But thinking these large terms,
to the Asilomar. So this is GMO is literally we've changed the genome of plants that are out in the environment, and they've been out for a long time now. Interestingly, let's do a case comparison. You know, if you go around the United States, most people are not concerned. Mm. They if they even know about it at all, they don't know whether they're eating a GMO or not. If you go to Europe, it's quite different.
Mm. Yeah, that's an example where there's an excessive anti-science suspicion in Europe. And despite the controlled experiments that's been done over here with 300 million people eating the stuff with no manifest ill effects, Europe still doesn't allow it, as you know. And that's an example. And so I think there is a danger of making people scared. And I think we've got to assert very loudly that we still think that the benefits of science outweigh the downsides. And we've got to make sure that remains so. Because the stakes are getting higher, and even a small probability of a massive downside is something that's worth worrying about.
I mean, you know, one of the things that Martin's thinking about this has led me to is, what are sort of the control structures on society that keeps it stable or allows chaos? And if you think back to 1914, there were small things, assassination of dukes and the Balkans and so forth, that led to essentially 30 years of chaos worldwide. Mm. And 50 million people died.
Right.
Now, in the 70 years since 45, there's been relative stability and peace. And people made choices. And each of these cases. So after 45, one wouldn't argue that the danger was less because of the growth of nuclear weapons. And in fact, we came within hours or days during the Cuban Missile Crisis of adding another probably 100 million dead to that pile. But we didn't. And so that's what gives me encouragement, is there have been these moments in which the threat of, if not annihilating the whole human race, having body counts in the 100 million range, were very real and present, not speculative, and we came within hours or days of that happening. And yet, some humans were able to prevent it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is it going to be? Are we going to have 1914? are we going to have 1962?
Yeah.
So it is that you can't predict how society is going to work, whether we are going to see these things coming and find a way to somehow avoid the worst downside. But we do have it within us to do that. And if you went back and you tried to sort of work out exactly what happened that went right in the one case and went wrong in the other case, it's not some grand theory. There were these small little changes, you know, that...
But if I asked you to sort of name a couple of things that without wanting to scare a public or turn it against science and so on, are nevertheless red alerts that you think people should be looking and paying a great deal more attention to and thinking about possible negative consequences of. I mean, what are the things that spring to mind? I mean, Martin, you...
Well, I would say bio threats and the vulnerability of the general international networks we depend on. Of course, we saw what happened in 2008 to the financial system, and we know we depend on multinational production networks for our manufactured goods. We depend on just-in-time delivery. We depend on GPS satellites and systems like that. And we are vulnerable, and the vulnerability now can cascade globally in a way it couldn't before. So I would say it's the interconnectedness of our world that makes us vulnerable to breakdowns of present technology. And my other worry is the misuse by error or design of advanced biotech.
Another concern, this is something Larry could comment on, is how dependent we become on the internet for both personal life in terms of keeping track of your own life, but more importantly for the whole working of the entire economy. And that's very vulnerable, because when it was planned, it wasn't planned for globalization. It was planned as a way to communicate between research labs, and the security and privacy and so forth were not put in properly. But now we know there are hackers who are out there who know how to manipulate it, and this is being done all the time. And it could be a catastrophic problem if they bring down the internet.
And more and more of our infrastructure actually is dependent on the internet, that is the electrical grids, the water, and so forth. But I mean, the thing that right now is, I think, in a sense, the test of humankind is actually climate change. This is not a speculation about the future. We just crossed 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It was probably 2 million years ago, long before. Homo sapiens only goes back 100,000 years. Homo erectus, maybe a million years. So no human being has ever experienced 400 parts per million. And most of the analyses of the growth, the doubling of the need of power, of energy by 2050 from where we are now, would say, most of those analyses would say, even with the best government intentions and abilities, we won't be able to stop at 450, maybe not even at 550. So we are changing the planet in a way it has not, into arenas, into ways that the global climate reassembles itself that we haven't seen for a couple of million years on this planet. And this is happening. And yet we seem to be like deer in the headlights. We seem not to be able as a people to deal with this current, essentially, planetary emergency. So that's what gives me discouragement about our ability to deal with some of these things. That President Johnson had a report on how the CO2 increase was going to change climate change. We have had many decades to deal with this. It's not that the facts weren't known, and we haven't. And so if we take just from Johnson till now, and we say, let's look that far in the future, and we take the biotechnology cross information technology revolutions, not to mention the nanotechnology, three-dimensional printing, drones, etc., that we see right now, and we project it that far in the future, are we going to be any more effective in coming to grips with those problems than we have since Johnson with climate change? And if so, where are the green shoots? Where are the things that are telling us that, like, our country would actually be able to get its political system back together and accomplish something? It's going in the opposite direction. So it doesn't have to. It just is. And this is more like the 1914 period. We couldn't react in a positive way, and we just let it all fall apart.
No, it is, it's almost as bad in other countries as in the US. And the main problem really is that climate change in particular, the main downside is a few decades ahead. And of course, economists discount this away. And certainly in the everyday concerns of ordinary voters, it doesn't rate very high compared to what's more immediate. And I think that's the inherent problem of any governance which is going to take these things seriously. And of course, cynics would say we need some real scare before anything happens.
Well, the other problem is that when everybody discusses this, it's the finger pointing at the other person, right? It's the Chinese that are causing this problem. Or, you know, there's... you know, it's more than just any single country can handle. It's it's got to be a multinational understanding. And there are some countries that, you know, for various economic reasons, would find that difficult.
Yeah, these, I mean, there's upsides to a lot of these things. Obviously, you're talking about the internet, communications, social networks, and so on. I mean, the mere fact that we're here, we emailed, we texted, we did all sorts of things. I mean, it had been the days of Henry Oldenburg in the Foundation of Society.
Yes,
the letter wouldn't even have arrived.
No, right.
I mean, it would be months. So let me finish on a quick note, a positive note here. When every day when we walk into this building, Terry and I, we walk over some steps, and there is a quote there of Jonas Salk's, which is centennial year of his birth, and it says, "Hope lies in dreams and imagination, and in the courage of those who dare to make dreams into reality." So what are the things that you see as the dream things, the reality things, the positive things, the optimistic things that are coming out of this period now?
Well, I think things like what Elon Musk is doing, both with Tesla, electric cars, and with SpaceX. I mean, I think it's quite possible during the next 50 years, I expect us to actually develop a solar system civilization of people living on Mars, living in space. But I think it will be driven more by the private sector. You know, maybe the deep explorations that we're doing now, the incredible triumph of the European Space Agency Rosetta satellite that after 10 years and billions of miles is now rendezvousing with a comet and about to land on it for the first time in human history and then ride it in toward the sun. I mean, humans are accomplishing things on a scale that made science fiction look pale. And we do this every day. And, you know, there's the threat of you know, bio hazards, you know, somebody making an Ebola that's transmittable like flu, but the very same technology that makes that possible is also making it possible to make vaccines within weeks of getting the DNA of that threat. So there's as much reason to have hope as there is to have fear. The question is whether society can organize the hope and the capability, or it, will it be paralyzed by the fear?
Elon Musk, of course, has just joined the advisory board of your Center for Existential Risk.
Yes, and he's rather worried about the AI risk, but I mean, I couldn't put it better than Larry has. I think we've got to accept that we have benefited hugely and there are more people living a good life on the world today than ever in previous history, and this can continue, and it's just simply that we have to ensure that we avoid the possible catastrophes, because the stakes are getting higher. I think as regards going to space, I'm not quite as bullish as Larry in that I hope that people will go into space, but I think they will be sort of crazy pioneers.
Yes.
There won't be mass emigration. I think we kid ourselves if we think we can solve the planet's problems by going somewhere else. We've got to solve them here. We've got to accept that nowhere else in the solar system is any more comfortable than the South Pole or the top of Everest. And the people out there will be pioneers. We wish them good luck. And they will eventually use all the techniques of bio and cyber to develop into a new species. And that'll be great. That'll be the start of post-human evolution. But I think we've got to solve the problems of the Earth here on the Earth.
Well, you know, Elon Musk is one of these people who wants to go to Mars.
He wants to he wants to die on Mars, but not on impact, he said.
Yes, exactly.
So I think all the problems we've been talking about can be traced to the fact that we're living with brains that evolved a million years ago that weren't prepared for the rapid changes that are occurring in the world. And the hope that I see is that we'll learn enough about our brain in the next 10 or 20 years to be able to change that. Literally speed up the rate of learning or our ability to cope with change. And we can already begin to see that happening with the Brain Initiative. The goal of the Brain Initiative is to develop new tools and techniques for being able to both record and manipulate brain activity so that we can speed up and accelerate the research that's being done and compress the next 100 years into 10. And I think that that's quite feasible. It's not going to take the economy of the U.S. to do it.
Well, to solve these problems will require the 3 pounds of wonder tissue that we all carry around on the end of our spinal columns, right? So
right.
We're talking about building better learners.
Well, improve the one we have. And I think that there's a long way to go.
All right. Thank you all for being here, Martin Rees, Terry Sanofsky, and Larry Smarr. And we've ended on an optimistic note. Thanks, James.
Thank you.